Born from the real-world needs of Resolve Marine, the Resolve Maritime Academy offers unmatched training for maritime or marine, firefighting, safety, and resource management. Our courses are taught by active professionals, providing hands-on experience that goes beyond industry standards. Whether you need STCW, USCG, or MCA certification, Resolve Academy will prepare you to mitigate emergencies, saving property and lives. Training as real as it gets, with real-world scenarios and live-action simulations. Push your limits, bring out your inner hero, and become an indispensable member of your team. Resolve Maritime Academy, where real-world training meets real-life expertise.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Yachting USA, the podcast. I'm Rick Thomas, your host, and this podcast is brought to you by Yachting International Radio. Today, I'm pleased and privileged to be sitting with an industry icon, a gentleman by the name of John Moores. John has been in this industry his entire life. In fact, he's third-generation boat builder. And I thought it would be wonderful to introduce him and have a conversation about his experience in this industry, talk about where he's come from, his family heritage, and his vision of where we are as an industry today. So, John, thanks for joining me. Welcome to the Yachting USA podcast.
Yep, nice to be here.
Good to have you. So I thought a good starting point would just be to touch on the history of your family. You are third generation, right?
Yes, in this country. Fourth generation in this country.
All right.
And my great-grandfather came by way of Baltimore and landed in New York as had a ship chandler on Pike's Slip downtown near where the Trade Center used to be.
Oh,
it's
wow.
All gone now.
In Manhattan, essentially.
Yep.
On the island.
Yep.
So. Wow. So you've seen an evolution of what that part of New York has had over the century.
Oh, yeah.
Crazy.
Well, he lived in the Greenwich Village on the Waverly Place, downtown Manhattan, and never married, but made a lot of money, I guess. He built a boat up in Millbridge, Maine, named the Sophia R. Lures, that is currently on the bottom of the ocean in New Zealand.
All right.
And the builder of that boat is a guy named Albert Strout. I remember going up to Millbridge one time and asking where the yard might have been, and the lady in the police office told me that everybody had named Strout in this town. She showed me a phone directory, and everybody's name was Strout, so it was hard to picture where the boatyard could have been, but...
Wow.
That's all history.
Good history, though.
Yeah.
And then go forward a couple generations. Your grandfather, also Henry Lures.
My father is named
Your
Henry.
Your father. Okay,
yes.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yep. He was born in Jersey City, New Jersey, and married my mother. I came along 3 years after their marriage.
All right.
And all I can do is remember he was building boats when I was a young not old enough to know what he was doing, but he built boats for Sears and Roebuck one time with little inboard air-cooled engines in them, little rowboat.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Because back in those days, I believe you could go to Sears and Roebuck catalog and buy a house.
Yeah, well, it could buy a boat, too. It came with, I don't know how many he built, but we had a whole cellar full of these Briggs & Stratton air-cooled motors.
Oh.
And I don't know how much the boat sold. I don't know how many he ever built, but... It must have been enough to keep us busy.
Now, I did a little research before coming up here and was reading about some of the boat building that he was doing. This is in the 40s and the 50s, and they described something called a clinker built, which is kind of like a lapstrake type construction.
Most of all his boats were clinker built boats. They had steam bent ribs in them, and they're generally built out of planking was built out of Jersey white cedar. And the keels and the stems were generally of hardwood of some sort. And he started building those boats during the period of time that were relevant to the economy. It was a little 20-foot boat that he got from an ex-rum-rummer that used to build, a guy named Marty Coford.
Those boats are supposed to go fast.
And he copied the boat and became quite successful at it.
Wow.
I've got some old photographs of the prices of those boats, and they used to sell for $1,500 or $1,800 with a motor in them.
Hard to imagine. I can't even pull my little boat out of the water for $1,500 anymore.
Not anymore.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
But that was your introduction to boat building then. You saw those boats being built, the steam-formed strakes.
And, oh, yeah. I grew up in that world. And my dad, when I got married, my dad had sold the company to a railroad company called Bangor and Arusik Railroad in Maine.
Right.
And they owned it for 10 years. And I learned a lot about business, professionally run business. I remember they sent me to Dale Carnegie course to learn how to treat people. So
there you go, how to make friends and yeah. influence.
So, but that, I lost interest in working for them in 10 years and started my own boat company called Silverton Yacht.
There we go. That's a name
and
we know.
That's a name. I built a lot of those boats. And my brother and I, it was built in Toms River, New Jersey, in Kettle Creek, New Jersey.
Yep. So, now, those first Silvertons, they were also wood boats, right?
Yes.
They were.
They started out to be all wood, but they turned out to be half and half boats. We built a fiberglass hull and a wooden cabin. And I remember our first year in business, we sold 7 boats at the Asbury Park Boat Show. And that got us off and running.
Wow. So, now, at that time, fiberglass boat construction was fairly new on the scene, wasn't it?
Correct. Fiberglass was all new.
Right. My father was a chemical engineer, actually went to college at Carnegie University in Pittsburgh.
Oh.
And he was an interesting guy because he was early working with polymers and things like that. And that was in the early 60s as well. So I have a little bit of insight into that, but I never saw it at that point in time in relevance to boat building. But you actually did bring that into your boat building.
Well, listen, I got a book from a Owens Corning company called How to Build Fiberglass Boats, so I still have the book.
Hey, there you go.
So it came a long way with that.
No doubt. So Silverton was one of the first brands.
Yes, that we developed.
These are all kind of like family cruiser type boats, inboard.
Only family recreational type boats. We didn't build any sport fishing boats, although a lot of them went fishing.
Right,
they weren't designed as sport fishing boats.
Right, yep.
And then most of the boats were all cruisers with lots of room and bunks and galleys and heads.
Right, useful.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. And what size were these boats?
Oh, the largest Silverton we built was probably 52 feet, and the smallest boat we built was 27 feet.
I'll tell you what, 52 feet back then was a big
boat.
Big boat.
Yeah, we have built very few of them.
Well, it makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah, it would make sense.
And we had while the company that my dad sold to, Bangor, had developed a West Coast facility that were built out in Costa Mesa, California.
Oh, wow.
And the bigger boats were built out there, and they got a very good reputation, and there's still a lot of them. If you go to Marina Del Rey, there's still a lot of the old boats still there.
Oh, that's something.
Because it's dry. And
yeah, the wood can stand up to
the weather.
Wouldn't see so many of those down here in South Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, we are coming to you guys today from St. Augustine, John's hometown, or his adopted hometown, and beautiful South Florida winter day today, and happy to share this with you guys in this beautiful environment we're sitting in together. Production, I saw some of the Lures production. You and I were at lunch recently, and you were talking about railway cars coming in stacked with plywood. And
Owens Yacht was our big competitor.
Okay.
Owens Yacht was in Baltimore, Maryland, and I remember going down there, and their boats were built out of plywood. But they had the biggest supply of plywood I've ever seen in my life. But they were cranking a lot of boats.
Wow.
And the big yacht builder was Matthews Boat Company years and years ago. And we never competed in that environment, but it was a boat product that I always admired, their quality and design.
Sure.
Oh.
It's a name that's still recognizable to some.
Oh,
for sure.
Yes.
Absolutely. Scaling up, though, from your production, obviously when you're steam forming structures and all that, way more labor intensive than forming up in fiberglass and setting molds and plugs and doing that. Where At what point in time did that change? Did you go
all fiberglass? Yeah. Eventually, we stopped building wooden boats and went all fiberglass boats. And I remember there was a company called Pacemaker Yachts in Lower Bank, New Jersey, that built a boat called All Glass. And they wanted to be sure that their boat was all fiberglass and not partially half and half boat.
Right.
So that's when we decided we better go for all fiberglass models because they had a name change.
Oh. Makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's the genesis of Silverton. That's how that...
Well, it was a good start. The company advanced from building power boats. And then one time I was on a cruise with a friend of mine, and we came back, and there was a thing when we were getting off the ship in New York Harbor. There was a thing my parents couldn't get up to get us because there was a thing called a gas shortage.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And right then it lit a candle in my cranium that said, well, if there's a gas shortage, maybe we better build a boat that's fuel efficient. So that's why we developed the mainship product.
And how did that differentiate from the Silverton product?
It was
the mainship's also
more fuel efficient.
Efficiency.
Yes. And the fuel efficiency, the boat took off quite well, and it sold a lot of them. Our first model was a 34-footer, and we built a 30-footer, then up to about 40 feet, and sold a lot of the mainship products, which also led us to building the Hunter Sailboat Company.
Well, I was going to take us down that path here pretty shortly, too, because I know you and your brother in particular, Warren, was an avid sailor.
Oh, yes. He did a lot of ocean racing.
Yep. And that's something we certainly wanted to kind of drill down into because there's a whole legacy around the evolution of sailing technology. When I got into the industry, I actually grew up in St. Petersburg, which was at the time kind of like the heart and soul of the sailing industry. And so that was how I cut my teeth initially. And then here I'm sitting with you and we're talking about Hunter, a company I did some business with at one point in time, and your brother who... set some records, and I'd love to hear
did a lot of ocean
his...
racing. Single-handed ocean racing was his bag, but that didn't appeal to me. And I did one race with him. I did two races with him, one across from Newport to England, and then I did another race with him in a boat he built called Thursday's Child around Britain, which was an event that I wouldn't want to repeat, but it was a great experience.
The little sea conditions, a little challenge?
Challenging all the way around.
Cold water?
Yep. Yep. And that led to... But it had a lot of influence with people that bought your boats. People that bought a Hunter sailboat knew that the owner of the boat or the owner of the company was an avid racing thing.
Well, I understand there was a record that was held for 130 years, clipper ship, running from, was it New York to...
New York to San Francisco.
You couldn't go through the canal.
He had to go around. He did that race with a couple of people, and it held for a little while, but somebody else beat it, but it was with a catamaran.
That's not fair.
Anyway, we've got lots of pictures of that around. So.
That's remarkable. And that, like you said, that's the type of thing that I think adds gravitas to a brand, to a...
Well, Rick, there was a couple of times that during the Hunter sailboat days that we used to sail some of our preliminary new models offshore and go from, say, St. Augustine to Bermuda just for a trial run. And my brother took one of his young children with him one time and made a film about it or a movie about it. This boat's good enough for me and my child. It's going to be good enough for you.
And we're not talking about a 50 or 60 or 70
foot. No, this was a small 27 or 30 foot boat.
Right, right. That's a real trip.
It was. And there's a lot of adventure stories about the Hunter products that we had, but they're all a memory now.
Well, it has been, and it's important, I think. This is what I love about this podcast and having these conversations, because these memories aren't going to last forever. We want to kind of capture the essence of what was. Because, as I've mentioned before, the idea I've got in what we're doing here is go back into this industry and understand where we all came from. And the individuals that became passionate about this industry and brought forward their ideas, their innovations, their enthusiasm. I don't want to get off topic, or I don't want to influence what we're going to talk about later in this podcast, but the enthusiasm, the individualism that drives so much innovation, compared to, you know, the corporate approach to things that we see so often. And I think there's a certain love that existed and potentially still exists. And that's what I'm trying to kind of get my head around is you didn't do that for any other reason other than really you found a business model that was that resonated, and there's true love for what you're doing. Obviously, that, you know, for Warren to take his family from St. Augustine across the Gulf Stream to Bermuda, hey, that's the real deal.
The other thing we did too, it only happened once. We often offered the opportunity for a news publication, a magazine article. The people who ran the magazine wanted to send one of their reporters with Warren on a trip, and there was only one guy that ever took him up on it. He said he would never do it again.
I was just going to ask. That was probably true.
Yeah.
It's, you know, being on the ocean's a real deal.
Oh, you bet.
You know, and
it's kind of like a winter's way and get in a cardboard box and have somebody throw cold water on you. You don't really
and
need
smile
it.
The whole way. You know, I love this. Do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. I used to work with a buddy of mine delivering Irwin sailing yachts in 68.
Oh, yeah.
Down island. We'd take them from the factory in St. Petersburg and bring them down to St. Martin, St. Thomas. And those trips were amazing.
Yeah. Well, they were a little bit more pleasant. So, well, the. Maybe this guy you should really talk to is our corporate attorney. Over the years, we had one guy who represented our firms, and he should tell you about all the lawsuits we got for people that were involved in some of our boats.
Would they get in over their head a little bit, maybe?
Well, not only we could always predict when things were getting bad because the economy would turn bad and they couldn't keep payments up with their boats.
Ouch.
And they'd find an excuse to sue you and get their money back. But there's a lot of lawsuits, some good stories, some funny stories, and some really tragic stories. So,
well, like in every business, I think some of that's inevitable. And
it happened to us all.
Yep, that's for sure. So were you and Warren partners in the business?
Yes.
You worked it together?
Yes.
Okay, and so you were developing the brand and you're developing
the boat
designs.
Yeah, we had a love for
boats.
Designs. Both
that's obvious.
Enjoyed.
Yeah.
He enjoyed sailing a lot, and I enjoyed the creativity part of it.
Yeah, you brought in other designers and innovators. People
very
that
much
were,
so, yeah.
I know the name Lars Bergstrom is going to resonate with
he's
some people.
He's one of them, but I can never take all the credit for the success of our companies over the years, but I want to say that a lot of people that worked for us contributed a lot of our success to their efforts, and they were a lot of wonderful people. So,
you're welcome to name names on this show because
well,
we,
I can't
like
name any names,
dots,
but I can tell you a quick story.
Sure.
One of the finest things that ever happened to me was that one day I was in a diner in here in town. And there was a black guy sitting down at diner, and he said, "You're John Lewis." And I said, "Yeah." So he moved over next to me, and he was halfway through with his meal, and I had just ordered. And he says, "I worked for you for some years, and I learned a lot. I learned to be an entrepreneur." And I said, "What do you mean? I hope I didn't hire you to teach you to learn how to be an entrepreneur." He says, "Well, I have my own grass-cutting business now and my own detail automobile cleaning shop." I said, "Well, that's very interesting." And the guy bought my lunch.
That
which
was some
really
gratitude
says
there.
Something from my ex-employees. So
yeah, well,
it was the
you
finest
know,
thing that ever happened to me.
That's kind of funny to hear you say that because as a business owner myself and hiring a lot of people, one of the most gratifying things
success.
Is success.
For other people
that's
to help.
Right.
But they contributed a lot to my success.
Of course they did.
I didn't do it all.
They believe in the business and the product, and they invest their time and their efforts and creativity, and then from that, you start seeing how things flourish. In our industry, renovation and refit is a pretty significant part of our business and is awful interesting to a lot of people. And I want to kind of talk about a boat that was built in 1892, a steam yacht called Kestrel. And John acquired that boat and spent some time and effort and money restoring her. And John, want to tell us about that little project? Because it sounds interesting.
Well, I got a habit of roaming around on when I see an empty boatyard and an old boat, I'm immediately drawn to it like a magnet. And there was a boat over in Richmond, Staten Island in the boatyard, and it was named Kestrel. And I climbed up in the boat. You can tell it was built well, but it was in deplorable condition. And when I got up inside of it, it had the original steam engine in it. It was built by the builder by the name of George Lawley up in Neponset, Massachusetts. And my wife was with me, and she says, "Well, what are you going to do with that?" I says, "I don't know," but she said, "You can't let it rot away. You want to restore it."
Right.
Well, I took the boat back to our boatyard, and I started to rebuild the boat, but there was this beautiful steam engine in it, and it was a three-cylinder double compound engine that was built for that particular boat. And I found a guy in Brooklyn, New York, who worked for the Pratt Institute, but he knew a lot about boilers and a lot about steam engines, and he volunteered to restore the engine, which he did do. And I restored the boat and finally got the engine back in the boat and ran it for quite a few years, and we had a lot of fun with the boat and enjoyed it a lot. And it came time to get rid of the boat, and I wanted to put it in a museum, and I've had a hard time finding a thing, but there was a guy named Bill Feichert that mentioned it to the Clayton Museum up in Clayton, New York, and they found a home for it at the Bolt Castle, and they accepted the boat, and we had it delivered up there where it still is today, and it's in the Bolt Castle boathouse on display with the engine. And you can still see it there today.
Does the engine still run?
It ran up until the time I took it out, yes. I had it totally rebuilt. A guy named Conrad Milster, God bless him, he did a beautiful job. And it was a labor of love for him, just as a labor of love with me. And
we love it.
So
truly, for those of us who are trying to get our head around our maritime heritage, North America has a wonderful maritime heritage. And some of the products and vessels that have been designed, developed, and built are really gems. They're incredible testimonies to what we do to put ourselves on the ocean.
Well, it was interesting. This fellow, Conrad Milster, he ran the boiler plant for the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. And he also was his teeth cut in the steamboat business. He used to run on some of the steamboats that ran up and down the Hudson Rivers, where he learned all about steam. Oh, he was an expert in it.
Right.
Running a steam plant.
Yeah, and steam did transform our country. That was the first really automated source of energy before we got into internal combustion engines that. So I think they were also used in some of the clipper ships and stuff for auxiliary power.
Well, listen, you can still see it. It's in the boathouse up in Clayton.
Well, I'd encourage anybody who finds themselves in upstate New York to go out of the way and take a look. It'd probably be well worth it. So, John, going back to Silverton, Mainship, Hunter, these are names that most of us in the industry recognize easily, and I think any of us who were in the industry in the early 2000s, 22, 23, 24, no, I take that back, 2003, 4, 5, especially leading up to 8 and 9, saw an economic downturn, and a lot of companies suffered from that, and I believe your companies are no exception to that. What did you see happening then?
Well, I don't know what the economy... I don't recall the ingredients that drove business. We always had a good year. We always made a profit from our products, and we've always been successful at building newer products that would sell at the point of... That's what runs thing we got. When we got in the sailboat business, we did quite well. We did well with the product Mainship, and Banger wanted us to get rid of the boat company called the Lures Company, which they bought from my father, and we bought that back from them. And they moved the company down here to St. Augustine, where it finally wound up building Lures Sport Fishing Boat.
That's when I met you first time. That's when I was introduced to your company.
Okay.
And that was the Lures that I got to know.
Well, we built a lot of Lures boats. It's hard to imagine how many boats we built, but...
Could you put a number to it? The reason I asked the question, I was at an event last month, or I guess not still this month, earlier this year at the Miami Boat Show, and I was honored to listen to Mr. Ferretti come up on stage. He was at a Robert Allen Law event, and Bob Allen did a great job of introducing Mr. Ferretti, and he has every reason to be proud of his brand and what he's done and what they do. And he was up on stage and he said, I'm proud to say that between 10 meters and 90 meters, we've built just over 13,000 yachts. And nice round of applause. And I listen, I'm taking nothing away from that because that's a real accomplishment. But as I understand it, you guys, between your brands, can talk about a whole lot more than 13,000 boats.
Oh, yes. Well, the best way I could estimate the amount of boats we ever built while I, or we, and my brother owned the company, you could take, we would always work 50 weeks a year, and we probably never built less than 6 boats a week, and we never built more than 18 boats a week. The bigger the boat, the fewer the numbers.
Yeah, sure.
So, if you take that and times it by 20 years or 30 years, you try to figure out yourself how many boats there are out there. I have no idea how many there are.
Well, I tried to do that math, and I'll stand corrected if anybody wants to come back to the table and correct me, but from what I can put together, somewhere north of 50,000 boats.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them around.
And when you think about what that represents, how many man-hours of labor, how many people were employed, how many subcontractors received their incomes and their business health from supplying and supporting the work that Lures, Mainship, Silverton, and Hunter produced, I think it's admirable. And I think when people talk about the yachting industry, and unfortunately there is enough people that would like to malign the yachting industry that it's an industry that supports hyper-wealthy people and it's useless, I would say quite to the contrary, that our industry, sure, we sell to hyper-wealthy people. We also sell to everyday families. And probably more than any other type of business, I think for the dollar spent, you put more people to work and create more value than almost any other type of consumer product you would buy.
Well, it's hard to imagine, Rick, how many boats we've built and how much we contributed to the economy. Paid my taxes. We did everything honest and legitimately. We had good people, and there's a lot of people that were very happy with our product. And
I continue to be, I'm sure.
And there's a interesting thing about it is that every time some of my friends travel around the world, they send me a picture of one of our boats in some remote place that they can take a picture and send it to me.
I love it.
And I always get a picture somewhere of comment. But they were in Tahiti or China or
they just shows,
Africa or
they show up
some lake.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. So the industry that you grew up in is going to be different than the industry that I'm going to bring out my son, Tristan, who happens to be behind the camera right now. So he came up with us today when he's voiced an interest in following in his dad's footsteps to some extent and being involved in the boating industry. Your view on what's changed over the years, because a lot has changed.
Oh, God, yes.
What would if you could identify two or three things that you think have fundamentally changed, for the better or the worse, I'd like to hear about it.
Well, things that have changed in my life, materials, and the creation of new materials and electronics, fiberglass. Look at they're making sails out of carbon fiber now.
Yeah.
So things, materials have a way of changing the industry. And it'll continue that way. That'll compel you to give a lot of serious thought to new opportunities.
New technologies.
Well,
absolutely. Are the boats, I know they're fundamentally different. Is the process of building the boats and the business of building the boats fundamentally different?
Well, I'll tell you, if I went back to building boats, one thing I would do today instead of doing it, I used to have a production line. I don't think I would use a production line anymore. What I would do is leave the boat in one spot and bring people to the boat and not have the boat move in its condition.
Okay.
Which is one idea I have.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that cleanliness means a lot. And if the party that's getting done with a job leaves a dirty thing, the guy coming into behind him is going to complain about it. So you got to clean up after you leave the job.
Right.
And that's one thing I would give some serious thought to, modifying the production methods.
I understand that. And I would tell you that one of the luxuries I've had in my career is the ability to walk into shipyards around the world and see how many different ways there are to build boats.
Oh, God.
And it is amazing. But one of the things that I've always found to be fairly consistent is if you walk into a shipyard and the floor is clean and the work areas are tidy and the tools are hung up and you walk on board the work in process and there's not piles of sawdust and everything is, you know, organized and clean, you fundamentally know that you've got a quality program.
Correct.
There. And the reality check is that's not consistent across the space.
Well, there's one of the things that everything. We used to do, too, with a lot of our vendors, we would say, listen, we'll buy your product, but we want to pay you once every 30 days for it. And engines we used to get in a truckload, and we'd use all those engines, and then at the end of that month, we'd pay the bill. And it would always help us. The cash flow was everything.
Sure.
So that helps a lot. And you can prepackage a lot of your material off-site and come and have your vendor pick up the bill of carrying it on his shelf until you needed it.
Well, there you go. And that's just in
time.
That's
a big important.
Yeah, that is. And in my manufacturing experience, we were involved in some of those programs. And managed properly, that's a great way to do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because it is cash flow program. But building boats is expensive. It's both labor and materials intensive. And the margins aren't necessarily always great. So
no?
You got to get it dialed in just right.
Well,
you concluded business when? In 2010?
About that, yes. Yeah, the last boat was built sometime around. We had a plant in up in Georgia, near Savannah, Georgia, where we built amainship products. That was the first and last boat we built.
Okay.
So
That had to have been a bittersweet moment, huh?
It's hard to say. I had never, ever realized how, I enjoyed my work immensely, and I would go on in life and continue with it. So
yeah.
Hopefully never retire. I don't like the word retirement. It seems to be a kiss of death.
Amen, brother. I tell you what, I'm feeling the same thing. I'm but younger than you, but I've had a few people come up to me and say, what are you doing, Ricky? You retired? And I'm like, where'd you bring up that R word from? That's not yeah, that's not good.
No.
This has been a real genuine treat to be able to sit and have this conversation. I wish I had the opportunity earlier in my career to have these conversations with you, because I'm sure the insight you bring could have been helpful for me and my business.
Didn't we buy a lot of stuff from you guys years and years ago, Hunter?
Hunter did. We sold some product to Silverton.
Oh.
I know I occasionally put a davit on some of the lures builds that were done. And
aftermarket. Okay.
Yeah, aftermarket stuff for sure. But, yeah, I'd have to go back through some of my history, but no, we certainly did some business with your shipyards, your boat building, and I would tell you that at that time I was early in my career, and frankly, I didn't know what I didn't know at that point in time. You had so much yet to learn, and
you don't
so
know
much
what you don't know, right?
You don't until you become more wise, and then you do decide you finally do know what you don't know, and that's also helpful. But John, I really appreciate your time, your insight, the opportunity to be on the record with you today here on Yachting USA. And I wish you just nothing but happiness and all the best in your future until you hit that point of when you are ready to retire.
I'm not going to use the word. Sorry.
Don't use that word.
No.
And I, again, thank you for giving us this opportunity. This is Rick Thomas, the host of Yachting International Radio's podcast, Yachting USA. I will look forward to our next conversation. And until then, be well.